Accession number 27258, Mr. Len Stockhill, Real 8. Now, what happened after Cochin then? Where did you go from
when
there?
Well, we went from Cochin to Australia, a very small place, which is an oiling station. Well, it was in the far northwest of Australia, and it was very, very dry.
Now, what we do, this is Onslow
oil. Onslow, O-N-S-L-O-W.
And what were you doing there?
We went there to oil up before we got our orders, was what we were doing, because we didn't know what we were going to do at that particular time. And it was a quaint place. There was a hitch rail outside the general stores, and if you went to buy any beer, you could get a gallon of beer, but you had it in quart bottles and in a box. But we were met by the chap in charge of the oiling station, and there was one or two of us invited to his house. And he invited us to house to have tea. So we went there, and his lad had been and caught some crabs. Well, his wife had dressed them, and we had this salad tea with crab. And his wife was a big buxom wench. And they had a corrugated roof on this shed, on this house. What the walls were made of was timber and something else. But what I noticed inside, where they were very, very clean, nice, you know, tablecloth and everything. But what I noticed on the wall was the tiniest bra. And she must have seen me looking at it. And the wife said, yes, she said. When I married him, she said, that fit me. And this chap was apparently in charge of the local Home Guard. He said, well, there was only three of them. And he said, we had that much ammunition. He said, come on, we'll go and have a shoot. So he had a flat truck. And he supplied us with Lee Enfield rifles, a box of ammunition, and away we went out into the bush. Well, we ended up, well, I let a shot of a turkey, a wild turkey, but all I could do was knock the leg off it, as it was in low flight, and the leg come off, and then it disappeared. So we ended up shooting at lizards, and then we come to a bridge, and we were throwing three tin cans into the river and then firing at them. But we loosed off quite a bit of ammunition. This chap didn't mind. And then he brought us back, and the lad took us to see where, this was the following day. The following day, we went to see this chap again, because there was 75% on leave, because we went out overnight, everybody stopped on board. So there was only the watch keepers that was on board ship. And we went out to see this chap again, and his lad took us to where he got these crabs. And was interesting, he had an old iron 5-gallon oil drum with the top cut off and holes punched in the sides. And he fastened a piece of meat in the bottom and threw it into this creek. Well, we were very hot, and we said, oh, we'd love a swim in this creek. Well, across the other side, it was an old Japanese pearling station, and the boats had been pulled ashore and hauled so that they couldn't be used. I think what had all gone on one boat, and when the war broke out, and smashed everything that was left. So anyway, we thought, well, we'll go and have a look. So we went and we swam in. It was while we were across there, after we'd had a look round, preparing to come back, this young lad, He said, sharks sometimes come up here. Well, you couldn't see us for splashes. I couldn't see it, not for dust, but for splashes. We were across that creek like Tarzan. And he didn't mention it until we were across the other side that the sharks sometimes come up the creek. Anyway, we enjoyed it though. These crabs he caught, I bet they were about 10 inches across the back. Massive thing, and massive claws as big as my wrist. And she cooked them, and we had crab again for tea again with this woman. And I think after about a week, we had to come away, but we'd got our orders.
This is an unusual trip you went on. We're interested in this. Tell us what you were doing, you know.
When we went from then on,
yeah,
we got our orders, and we had to go around all these different islands. About three ships of us. But we had so many islands allocated to us. And it was the Maldive, Lakadive, and the Cocos Keeling. But there were other islands that had no names, but they belonged to groups. And we had to anchor off these islands and send a boat ashore. I'm telling a lie. I'm going before my story. We had to come back to Trincomalee, where we got our orders. And also, so many doctors were put on board. And these doctors had done their time in the Far East, and they were coming back to Great Britain. But they gave them a job to do on the way back, which was on the destroyers. And also took off a lot of young members of our crew and changed them with older members that were due for demobilisation when they got back to UK. But the job that these doctors had to do when we sent a boat ashore to these small islands was to check if they were inhabited, to check if there was any disease, or whether there'd been a pilot downed and stopped on the island, you know.
A British or American, I presume.
British or American, anybody that did, or anybody. And as I say, each island we went to, we had to. Some of them had a lot of hutments. Others had only just one, you know. Some had none at all. There was nobody on the islands.
Now, would you search the island, or would you just have a quick look?
We had to go around them. There was a boat crew went ashore. I think it was about two doctors, and the boat crew would pull the boat ashore and then just search the island. When we got to the bigger islands, we got to know who was in charge, and then they more or less told us what had happened, you see. We had no searching to do.
Now, did you find any pilots?
No, not a one.
And what about any health problems?
Any disease, no. No disease at all. What we did know, there was also on one of the islands an RAF rescue station. And we used to pull alongside their jetty to when we came ashore. And we only came ashore to sort of have a look round and a swim. But when we were moored right out in the bay, about 20 foot deep, and water was as clear as clear, and you could see hammerhead sharks. And I'd never seen a hammerhead shark, and they looked like a hammer, big broad thing. And you could see them just swimming slowly about the bottom, like that, 20 foot down. But they reckon that they don't hurt you, the hammerhead ones, I don't know. Wouldn't risk it, anyway. We did our swimming just on near the beach.
Now, anything happen? I mean, it sounds quite an interesting job, looking at all these islands.
It was.
It's in the Pacific and Indian Ocean, is it?
Yes, Indian and Pacific Ocean, both.
Anything you remember
South Pacific. We were told that, what did they call the Queen? She was reigning at the time on one of these islands. And the next time I heard of her, she was over for the coronation. Oh, she was a big woman, typical native. But she reigned on this island. She was the queen. I forget her name, but at the time she was well known. And as I said, it revived me when she came across for the coronation.
Anything happened during these visits?
No, nothing unusual. As I said, we had all these doctors on board. But the doctors, when they came aboard, their suits had been, they'd been out Far East quite a while, and their suits had got mould on them and things like that. So Alf and I, having nothing much better to do because the guns were all sort of sealed up more or less then, we started a dobing firm, but it was mainly these officers' uniforms. We got these officers' uniforms off the officers. We cleaned the mould off, brushed them all down, and we steam pressed them till they were like new again. All blue serge suits. Had on hangers, trousers all pressed. And what we didn't find in the pockets was nobody's business. There was money-wise. There was 10 bob notes, 5 pound notes that they couldn't use in Australia or wherever they'd been. So we had that, and we said to them, what about this money? Oh, you keep that, you know. So we had, and we did about 10 suits, full dress suits, and some shirt, white shirts we did. So we got quite a lot of money off of that for to buy stuff before we came home, but that was later on.
Now, you buy souvenirs, you mean? What sort of stuff would you buy?
Well, I didn't buy many, so apart from photographs. We got these photographs of different places that we went to. I don't know where they were got, probably the lads have took them when they were little. Alf used to do the writing. He was a better writer than me. He'd write on the back of these. We used to buy one each, the same. And he would write on the back where they were. Then he would keep one now at the different places we were at. But when we were in Sewers, I bought a...
This on the way back?
On the way back. I bought a thing. The woman was doing them in the shop, like sort of on an embroidery machine. And it was blue material, and she put on it HMS Cowdray, and then the year, and then... Doreen Stockhill on the side, you know, on the machine. Bought that, but what we mainly wanted was to, when we got to Jib, we called in Bombay on the way back, and we bought suitcases. Alf and I bought a big suitcase, massive it was, and we packed a lot of stuff in there that we bought. Like dressing gowns, sheets that we bought. We bought the sheets for our own use, but we didn't use them in our hammocks. But we didn't use them, we put them in this case. And then when we got to Jib, we bought a lot of perishable stuff. We bought tins of butter and... tea, lots of stuff that was rationed that could be carried. I mean, the was tin butter, and there was tin something else. But then we bought bananas, green as green. Bought a lot of dried fruit, muscatels, dried muscatel, raisins, sultanas, all dried stuff. We bought a lot of that, which they hadn't seen in the UK. And we made a special box up for that and fastened it all up, packed it all down. The bananas we kept as cold as possible, you know. We got back to Malta. We weren't long in Malta. I think we picked a few passengers up that were coming back to UK. And we called in Jib, got these, what we used to call rabbits, all goodies that we wanted to bring home.
So when did you get back?
No, we got back. Now let me see, I'll have to work that out. It would be early December. Early December we got back into
1945.
Chatham. Yeah. Early December, yeah.
And were you demobilised straight away?
No. No. Not demobilised till I think it was the I wasn't actually finished. We demobilised about the 24th of December. That was letting us come home. But our final papers didn't until February.
So you had leave?
We had leave to go on to that. And my final discharge was February. So let's see you somewhere.
It says April in here.
9th of February it was. I started work in May. I thought I might have got mixed up there. But it was February. It's official.
And was there any particular procedure about being demobilised?
Well, yes, we were given a medical, which was A1 for both of us. By this time, Alf and I were quite close. And when we first docked, they also issued with certain civilian clothes.
Demob suit.
A suit, shirt, tie, hat, and a Macintosh or overcoat, whichever we wanted. But before then, though, they gave us 2 days leave. Well, that's not unusual in the Navy in Chatham. You'd go on leave and if you live far away, you went into digs or to the naval home, whichever. But Alf took me to his home because he lived at Welling in Kent, which wasn't far away. And we went there. And we had a couple of days with him. I met his wife and his lad. And then we went back to the ship. And we were finished our demob procedure, which, as I say, entailed having this suit measured, you were measured roughly to this suit. They weren't made to measure, but there were so many sizes.
Were they any good?
I wore mine for quite a while, but they were nearly all the same. It was a grey pinstripe. Shoes I wasn't too bad for. Although I would have been better off if I hadn't had my hammock pinched. See, I'd acquired a spare hammock, and when we handed all our kit in, I handed a hammock in, because in my own hammock that I had all sorts in it. Two pair of what we call deck slippers, were just like shoes. And some spare sheets. Ever so many different things in it. And it got pinched. Somebody working about the depot that knew what used to go on had nicked it. So I'd lost them. And they, what we called deck shoes, they were like a shoe, only had a thin sole. But you could take them to the cobblers and have a thick sole put on and heel. And you were just like ordinary shoes.
Now, what happened when you were demobbed then? What were you going to do? You got back?
I got back. We got back off this couple of days' leave. And as I say, we were issued with our clothes. And then we were given our papers to go on leave and be demobbed. We were demobbed proper. And this was just before Christmas. But I had this box this case and a kit bag to carry. And I couldn't manage all them to the station in King's Cross. So Alf had the bright idea of us both going, taking our stuff to his place. We left it on the station. I looked after it. He went home and brought the pram. We loaded all our stuff on this pram, took it to his house. We stayed overnight in. I stayed overnight in his house. Then the next morning, he comes down to the local railway, Welling Station, helping me with all my gear. And he saw me onto the train at King's Cross with all my stuff. And I got a taxi when I got to the other end. I got to Hartlepool. And I got
home. What sort of reception did you get from the missus? You must have been pleased.
Well, the boy, the youngest son, was the elder, the second son wasn't born then, but the youngest son didn't know me, obviously, and I'd bought him a little sailor suit, which wasn't big enough when we found out. But he was pleased with the banana. He didn't know what a banana was. Well, by this time, they'd all nicely ripened by the time I'd gone home. He didn't know what a banana was. And eventually liked them. And of course, the wife was pleased to see me and the mother-in-law.
Did it take long to get round the little lad?
Not long. He eventually come round, but you know, it's very strange. We've never been really close. Not as close as I was to the youngest lad. Because I was there at his birth, like, you know, when he was first born. But the eldest lad, all right, we got on all right together. But we couldn't work together. You know, if we were doing something in the garden, couldn't work together.
And you think it's pushy work?
It gradually changed. We came very, very close.
But it did affect you at the start then, obviously.
It did, yeah, it did.
Now, what were you going to do for a living? I mean, you'd been in the army for ages, but I mean, the whole war.
Yeah, well, nearly
army and navy. I mean,
6 years, nearly.
So what were you going to do?
Right. There's only one thing I knew, apart from being a soldier or a sailor, was butchering. Well, I was called up during my apprenticeship. Well, they had a scheme where you could go back to night school. If I started back at my job, which I did, and I started on, I think it was May the 6th, 1946. Yes, I started back work then. Nearly 10 years after I'd left.
No, you started.
Did I?
It says that here. I mean, it was only about 7 years after you joined.
1936. Well,
the war didn't start in
1936. No. It was 10 years from when I'd originally started work. That's right. I started work in 1936 when I was 15.
Now, was it at the same butchers?
And it was for the Co-op. I went back to them, yes. But a lot of the lads had been away and they come back and they'd all wanted their jobs back, but some of them hadn't come back, and it was a while before I was made foreman. You know, you had got to wait your turn.
So did you settle down to civilian life quickly? All of it? I mean, you saw life in
it. I settled down normally for the simple reason was I had to. I had a family, an extended family, my wife's mother and father.
Did you have any problems doing that? I mean, I know you had to, but did you find it difficult?
Not really, no. Apart from the youngster who didn't know me at the beginning, because he was born in 43 and he was only like 2 year old. Just over two. It was not exactly worrying to me at all. It didn't worry much at all.
You settled in.
Sort of settled in, yes. Fairly
any quickly. Any after effects for you, a mental or physical?
No. I was still fit. I'll give me that. I was still fit.
Did you meet your old comrades? Did you go either naval or army?
I met one of them, George Muir. That I met him once, well, twice, after I come home, and that was once. I met him, and he came down, asking me to get my brother to give him a lift down to London because his wife had left and gone back to St. Albans. That was another story. And then the next time I met him was when on holiday.
So this is what, you didn't meet Alf again then?
I met Alf again. I met Alf, I was in Industrial Orthopaedic Hospital in London, the Golders Green, for my knees. I had operation on my knees. But I'd taken my car down, but I had a disabled badge.
So this is, you didn't see him for 40 odd years?
No. Oh, I did. I beg your pardon. We were on holiday at St. Albans, and our Brian, he was just 12 year old. So this would be
55.
Nine years.
Why didn't you keep in touch with him?
We used to write. We used to write, but we didn't physically see him, each other, until we went on holiday down to St. Albans, and Brian was about 12. And we went down from St. Albans to London to see the Trooping of the Colour. Well, we went down early morning, got the train to St. Pancras, and I thought, right, we'll go and see if we can find Alf. I knew he worked for the Star, and I knew he was a machine manager, and I knew where Fleet Street was. So we go down to Fleet Street. This was long before the Trooping of the Colour, of course, in the morning. And I didn't know where to look, so I went into this main office building, and there was a commissionaire on. And as soon as I mentioned I was looking for an old army pal of mine, he was straight away, "Yes, sir, what can I get for you? Give me the details." I said, "Well, I call him Alf Acaster, and I know he was a machine minder for the Star." And he said, "Yes, this is the Star building." He said, "Just a minute." And he went on the phone. He said, "Right, come with me." And he took me across the road into this other factory and up these stairs. And he went through this door and he come back with Alf. Well, of course, Alf was quite pleased. "Oh," he said, "come on, we'll have a cup of coffee." So we had a cup of coffee in the factory, it was the printing room. And then, I introduced him to Brian. And he said, "Well, when we've had a cup of coffee," he said, "I'll take some time off." And he said, "I'll go and get you a good vantage point for to see the Trooping of the Colour." And on the way down, because there's guardsmen selling programmes. Well, he bought one and gave it to Brian. Well, he still got it. He got this Trooping of the Colour programme. And he took us to this vantage point, which couldn't have been better, because he said, "If you sit on here," he sat Brian up on this chair. There was a crane with a cameraman on the top. Well, we had a good view there, because what they covered, we could see.
Now, so was it any change at all? Was it good to see him?
Oh, it was good to see him, yeah.
But you didn't see him again until
Not till a few years later. I went to...
Was it just you don't go to London very much then?
When I went to hospital, I did. I used to go regular to this Industrial Orthopaedic Hospital, because I had trouble with both knees.
So you never really kept in touch, meeting him regularly?
Oh, no. It was just three occasions only. The Trooping of the Colour was one. Second time I met him when he was at Welling in Kent. And the third time He'd moved house, he'd retired and moved house, and he'd gone down to East Coast. So while I was in the hospital, I thought, right, I'm